means we support for people to stay in their homes, that they are not forced to migrate. So that's one key message we have to say. Invest in climate action. It gives people a choice whether to go. They have the right to move if they want to move. But let's not make migration a last resort, a tragedy, when it's too late, when there's nothing else.
Well, Diana Ionescu, we thank you so much. We're going to do part two and post online as a web exclusive at democracynow.org, head of Migration, Environment, and Climate Change at the International Organization for Migration. I'll be speaking in Berlin on Saturday night at 7:30 at the Festhal Kreuzberg. Check our website. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Radina Guzdern, Carla Wills, Laura Guybas, Dina Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's 8 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Voices from the Edge is next. Carrie and Amory from the Native American Youth and Family Center will discuss mental health in the Native community, plus the intersection of environmental justice and education, coming up in just about 2 minutes.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Water is Life. Youth speak out on the impacts of fracked gas export. On Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevera Shalom in Portland. Water is Life will include a panel of youth from the Yurok, Hoopa, and Karuk tribes, traveling all the way from Northern California to share their perspective, and a video recently produced by the Klamath tribes in Southeast Oregon in opposition to the massive proposals to pipe, liquefy, and export fracked gas through the Northwest. Again, that's Water is Life. Youth speak out on the impacts of fracked gas export on Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevera Shalom, 825 Northwest 18th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Thanks for Giving, a Give Guide Happy Hour with Human Solutions, ERCO, and KBOO on Monday, November 20th at 5 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room in Portland. Human Solutions is partnering with KBOO and ERCO to say thank you to their donors and to celebrate being included in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. The evening includes beer and snacks as a way of saying thanks for giving to all their supporters. Again, that's Thanks for Giving, a Give Guide Happy Hour with Human Solutions, ERCO, and KBOO on Monday, November 20th at 5 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room, 237 Northeast Broadway Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:02 a.m. I'm Amory Shack.
And I'm Carrie Waters. You are listening to Native Voices from the Edge.
Hey, hey, hey. Oh, oh, oh. Whoa. People, and we have to reunite. I say, better gather up our warriors, cause tonight is the big fight. Hey, 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 hey. Oh, 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 oh. Hey, 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 hey.
We have some great conversation for you this morning, and our approach to all of our conversations comes from a relational worldview model.
Yeah, this concept of a relational worldview model has guided my work over the years, and it's an essential way of viewing all of the issues that impact our community. We can't look at any one issue in a vacuum because everything is related anyway. So the relational worldview model posits that health is interconnected and we should approach it as such. So mind, body, spirit, and social context all have to be taken into account. And I think we might have touched on this last week or the week before, that, you know, there's a role for everyone in the movement. We have to build the new and fight the bad. And there are many roles that different people can fill. So as we approach issues within our community, you know, it's been my practice over the years to recognize that, you know, just because I have a specific passion, you know, in environmental justice, for example, climate justice, healing of land and people, that, you know, I'm really grateful that there are folks out there working on foster care issues and education, and you know, there are many different realms that folks have strengths in and interests in, and I'm really grateful that we're all here to, you know, complete this puzzle together, and that it's a collective endeavor. We can't just approach it all with, you know, one single solution as a silver bullet, so to speak, to all of our problems. We have to strategically approach our community's challenges mm-hmm. through a recognition of strengths and also, you know, by recognizing that we need a diverse array of community building opportunities and solutions. So that's why I'm grateful for our guests that we have here today. We'll be talking about issues ranging from mental health in the Native community with Denise Wickert in the second half of the hour. And in our first half, I'm really grateful to have our first guest, Tracy Price, who joins us to share her take on environmental education, environmental justice, and the confluence of these two concepts as ecological justice, which we touched on a bit last week as well. Tracy has a background in outdoor recreation, psychology, and kinesiology. Tracy has worked on policy, strategic planning, and coalition building to ensure that all people have the opportunity to experience, understand, and care for our natural world. Tracy has worked in the world of environmental education for the past decade, and I've had the honor of knowing and working with Tracy over the last 2 years. Welcome, Tracy.
Thank you, Carrie.
Yeah. So could you start by just telling us more about your background?
Sure. Yeah, my background is in kinesiology or sports psychology. I grew up playing sports, organized sports, and especially playing tennis was pretty mental. So yeah, very, very, so I studied sports psychology, and a lot of what I looked at was group dynamics, how people work together, how we recreate, what we do when we retire, how we mm-hmm. take care of ourselves, mm-hmm. all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I started working in environmental education really through that approach. So taking kids camping and hiking and rock climbing and backpacking and rafting and really getting kids outside connected to the natural world where they lived.
That's fabulous. So did you always have this passion? You said you grew up with, you know, this passion for sports. And so was that always in your mind that you wanted to help foster that with others, or
no.
When did that hit?
Definitely not. But some of my earlier formative memories, I mean, I can remember sitting at the end of my parents' driveway and there was a honeysuckle bush, and I can remember just devouring the honeysuckle bush mm-hmm. or feeling like I got lost in a tiny patch of trees that were next to my mm-hmm. house. And so I think early on, you know, those were the places where I felt like I was connecting. And so I guess it was always a part of my experience, but it really wasn't until I sort of fell into it. I think I fell into doing this work, and then just seeing the ways that kids from all different backgrounds really can recreate, can experience nature, and really is like a therapeutic experience, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, that reminds me of conversations that we've had over the past couple of years through our project on ecological justice and environmental education, environmental justice, you know, that we all have those different memories of when we first engaged with the environment. And, you know, for me, I was really grateful to have access to a little stream near my house where I could explore nature and wildlife and, you know, just be amongst the cedars and all of the little birds and all of that. But, you know, I recognize that some folks, you know, their first interaction with the environment was maybe through asthma because they live next to a freeway or, you know, an interaction that's with the built environment. And so I think that's an interesting dynamic as well. Could you speak to the interface between the built environment and the natural environment?
Yeah, I can certainly try. Yeah, and whether asthma or growing up in an apartment that has mold or whatever a family may experience, sure, lots of different ways people can interact with the environment. And I think that really plays out in terms of the perception, right, that like mainstream environmental education has about, or even more broadly, the mainstream environmental movement has about the ways in which we sort of expect people to be interacting with nature. And I think it's often really limited in terms of, you know, it's got to be this rugged individual who goes out like John Muir or Ansel Adams, right, and who can be alone in the wilderness. And we know that there's a deep history of really sort of racist approaches in that perception. So I think it really does play out, and it's I think we're at a time where there's a huge opportunity for people to realize that there are a complexity of ways in which people may engage with their environment, including their built environment.
Thank you. Could you share with our listeners, what is the Environmental Education Association of Oregon?
So the Environmental Education Association of Oregon, I will say EEAO, which is a vowel acronym, but it's been around since the 70s. You know, it was largely sort of a grassroots organization, volunteers, folks who were really mostly looking at youth and how youth were interacting with nature and their environment, but definitely spans to include all ages as well. And so, you know, over the years, it's a small nonprofit, mostly volunteer run with the board. And I would say, so over the years, EEAO has done a number of different things, from hosting annual conferences to helping to play a role in the No Oregon Child Left Inside work, which we might talk about. And I think more recently, you know, the board has been exploring a lot around diversity, equity, inclusion. What does that look like to integrate that into an organization and with its network? And what role can the organization play really in helping to build that kind of shared analysis and relationships across difference across the state? So, yeah.
That's great. So I'm going to revisit this No Child Left Inside Act. Could you share the story of how that came about?
Sure. Well, Oregon as a state does not have any dedicated funding or infrastructure. Actually, we do now with outdoor school, with the bill that ballot pat that passed last year. So we do have some dedicated state funding for that, which is great. Big win. But other than that, Oregon as a state does not have any dedicated state funding or infrastructure really to support environmental education, or how we might think broadly of what environmental education might be. We have a lot of state agencies and groups that are certainly doing a lot of great environmental education, but we don't really have a coordinated approach as a state. And so back in 2009, we passed the No Oregon Child Left Inside Act. And what that act did was basically allow or encourage us to create an environmental literacy plan. And this environmental literacy plan is really a framework for K through 12 to encourage the use of the outdoors and the local community as a context for kids to learn. And it's actually housed at Oregon State University Extension. They've got an environmental literacy program that's really working with educators across the state to figure out how to implement this framework. And so I will say that it was a great opportunity for, you know, 60 partners, 100 partners from across the state to really work together to think about what this might look like to encourage that kind of learning for kids. And at the same time, it was an epic fail in terms of engaging with and following leadership from communities of color, low-income communities, in terms of their input and integration into the things that we sort of touched on when we started talking about all of the different ways that people may experience the environment and natural world. So it's a great opportunity, again, to encourage, you know, sort of that local context for education. And there's so much more that could be done to really infuse a lot more perspective from culturally specific community-based organizations. And so I know some of that work is happening, and I'm excited to see where that can grow.
That's great. Thank you so much. And so what are some of these opportunities that we can take on to build a just, equitable, diverse, and inclusive environmental education system? And what do those different concepts look like? Because, you know, I know it's not enough to just have a more diverse environmental education system. We can't just keep playing the same game and expect different results. We have to fundamentally shift the paradigm. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts or examples of what that has looked like. I know there was that process to review the standards of excellence for environmental education. Was that with the North American Environmental Education Association?
I mean, really, it's a simple fix, right? Just kidding.
Nice, quick fix. Silver bullet.
And I think, you know, I mean, it's, you know, like you were talking about these intersections of all these different sectors. I mean, I think the environmental education and the environmental movement is not alone, right, in thinking about how what its current paradigm looks like, which we know is really couched in a history of white culture, of white supremacy, all these characteristics really that have sort of been foundational to what the current practice looks like. And so I think that, you know, a project that you and I are working on, which has been awesome, is we've been bringing together partners who are from both mainstream environmental groups who do environmental education and community-based culturally specific groups like Wisdom of the Elders and Opal Environmental Justice and NEA, and really looking at, so how do we co-create a shared vision for our region, in this case, around inclusive environmental education? And what does that even mean? And are we talking about, like you said, I mean, we're talking about more than just diversifying a current practice, because if we do that, we're not necessarily changing anything about the practice itself and the paradigm. And so I think really what we're talking about is how do we approach environmental education in a more transformational way. And so we've recently started looking right at how we integrate the Movement Generations Just Transition framework, which I'm really excited about. And so what would it look like to reframe environmental education programs, practices within this context of their vision for a more regenerative and caring and cooperative society? And again, I think there's a huge opportunity for environmental educators and even the environmental community as a whole to start to look at the kinds of initiatives like the Just Transition Framework or even the Movement for Black Lives and the platform they came out with that has environmental goals in it, right? How is the environmental community, including education, aligning with efforts and initiatives that are being led by and supported by communities of color and low income? Mm-hmm. And that's really a paradigm changer if we're able to do that work. And that's also about recognizing, again, there are so many more ways to experience and to think about our interactions and relationships to the natural world. And so I think I know there are a lot of mainstream environmental ed program providers who are looking to diversify their work or make it more inclusive and equitable. And it really takes a practice really that starts, I think, on the individual level, you know, for folks to really consider, like, why is this important? Why do they want to change their practice? And why, you know, if somebody's thinking, well, we want to recruit, we want to engage, we want to work with, you know, communities of color and low-income communities, it's like, well, what are they already doing, right? And we know that there's just so much to be learned from each other. And mm-hmm. so I think the more that we can really have a deep analysis around the history of race and racism and looking at why certain communities may be engaging in ways that they are because of the limitations that society has imposed on them over history, right? That's important to understand in terms of what you can do now in terms of connecting across difference. Mm. So I think it's having that deep analysis and continuing to deepen an analysis around race and racism and other isms and develop deep relationships across difference. And those, you know, people talk about partnerships and it's like, well, partnerships are relationships. Mm-hmm. So what works well in your personal relationships will likely also apply to the way that you're developing partnerships. And then I think balancing, you know, spirit of equity and inclusion in those conversations. So we're careful not to just flip the paradigm on its head with different people in power, but that we, you know, that we create space or experience space where voices and perspectives and wisdom and leadership from communities who have not historically been in those positions, especially in the environmental movement, can lead, and the mainstream groups can follow a little bit more, and we can also find like new and exciting ways to work together.
Love it. Love it. So you touched on a concept that I've been wrestling with for quite some time. This idea of individual change versus institutional change. Mm. So could you speak to perhaps the different scales or concentric circles
Sure.
of change?
Yes. And a big shout out to Center for Diversity in the Environment for really Oh. being so instrumental in I know my journey along this. And so the theory of change that I talk about, which is social change theory, and a lot of what the Center for Diversity in the Environment promotes is really an understanding that in order for change to happen, it has to happen on a variety of levels, right? It's got to happen on individual, interpersonal, institutional, organizational, movement-wide levels, and that there isn't just one direction where change happens, right? It's not like you start at the individual. I mean, starting at the individual level is always good, because if you don't know why you're committing to the work that you're doing, you're not going to get very far, and it's probably going to be pretty superficial. Mm-hmm. But so you don't start there and then finish, right? You don't start with the individual, move on to your interpersonal relationships and then organizational and think you're all set as an individual, right? I mean, we're constantly changing and growing, and there's always an opportunity for us to learn more. So it's a matter of committing to activities, you know, and being motivated to actually create change across all of those levels. And I think, too, the more that we talk about the systems and the institutions and what we're seeing in terms of barriers at that level is an important conversation to have and can sometimes help alleviate, you know, that sense of guilt and shame that individuals, especially white folks, might feel in terms of engaging in this work, you know, thinking like, well, I'm not a bad person. Like, well, it's not really about you as an individual. It is, and it's about addressing these systems and these institutions. So in what ways, I think people can always consider, like, in what ways are you not only working on yourself and your relationships, but ultimately addressing these systems and mm-hmm. institutions that we know are the biggest barriers?
Absolutely. Something you just said reminded me of, you know, the fact that the relational worldview model can inform both our health at the individual level, the organizational level, the societal level. So, you know, for example, as we think about the mind, you know, I think about my own mental health and how I foster, you know, a lifelong learning pursuit, and, you know, what that looks like on the organizational level. It might look like, you know, research and evaluation. And as you look at the body quadrant, you know, that could also be infrastructure or human capital or other types of physical resources. You know, at the spirit level, the why, as you were talking about, definitely fits within that framework of understanding why we're doing something, what the mission of an organization is, core values, and fostering that local to global approach. Because, you know, sometimes we can be here in our little Portland bubble and see gentrification happening and all of these other challenges. And then, you know, we go out to other communities and learn that many of these challenges are persistent across the West Coast, across our nation, across the globe. And yeah, I think that's a fabulous transition into a larger conversation about, you know, social context as well, you know, like within the Native community and other communities of color. We, you know, we can sometimes feel this sense of scarcity and mm-hmm. Isolation as we, you know, sometimes fight over crumbs as opposed mm-hmm. to working together cross-culturally to expand the pie. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm I'm really passionate about, you know, thinking about how we can move forward into this place of solidarity, as opposed to fighting together or fighting against one another for the limited resources. And that gets back to the Just Transition Strategic Framework, you know, values filter of thinking about how we have to move the resources, move the power, and ultimately change the game. So what would it look like for you to change the game of environmental education in the Portland metro area and perhaps in the state of Oregon?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's it'll be really interesting to see how we can align more environmental educators and their programs and their work with the Just Transition Framework. So I think it feels very, very, excuse me, it feels really tangible in terms of the ways that people can look at the work that they're doing and how are they, again, supporting this vision for a more, you know, regenerative economy and caring cooperation and all of those things that I think many of us would like to see in society. So I think there's that. And I think, you know, like you mentioned, this idea of human capital. And the more I think that people are aware of all of the places in their own lives, their connections to decision makers or resources or funders or whatever it is, you know, you bring all of those connections into the relationships you're developing. So I think the more that we can connect with one another across difference, bringing all of the many ways, you know, that we have connections with our community, it just feels like, you know, our potential is so limitless in terms of like how we can support one another by leveraging even more human capital or more social capital, whatever it is, like to accomplish our shared goals. And I think the more we see how the things that we care about are really a lot more interconnected than we've been led to believe by dominant society, I mean, yes. I think the better we'll all be and more opportunities. So.
That's powerful. I know y'all had an event on Monday through EEAO on environmental justice. Could you share some highlights?
Yeah, sure. So we had Opal Environmental Justice does an environmental justice 101 training, and they typically offer it for onboarding new volunteers. And so it seemed like it was something that might be of interest to the broader environmental ed community in Portland. And so even with, you know, maybe 3 weeks notice, you know, we sent out an invitation with not a whole lot of advance notice. We had about 50 folks sign up. So I think more than anything that it really confirmed this notion that like folks in the mainstream environmental ed community are really interested in that intersection with environmental justice. And I think they're eager to learn about like what they can do to help. And Huey, I, if you're listening, I mentioned that you said this before too, right? Is that we're not just building bridges between the work that we're doing, but we're looking to like, how do we construct a boat that we can all float down the river together in? Mm. So, folks are interested. Yeah.
That's good amazing. Stuff. Yeah. Amazing. Mm-hmm. I love it.
I love hearing it.
Yes. So powerful. You know, and as we think about this Just Transition Strategic Framework and, you know, shifting to this new paradigm, you know, I'm so encouraged by the relationships that we've built through this partnership. And, you know, I have seen a significant shift over the past couple of years, you know, through our partnership with 350 PDX and, you know, other organizations that recognize that we have to elevate the voices, experiences, and solutions grounded in communities of color. And that there's no need to reinvent the wheel. As you were saying, it's not about just, you know, creating new different types of programming for communities of color within mainstream organizations, but really looking to what's already happening that might not necessarily be named as environmental education, but absolutely is. And, you know, I think of some of our activities that we have, you know, out back in the Whitaker Ponds as community members engage in canoe activities or, you know, going out into the natural world to gather tea and learning about the, you know, culturally significant plants that have medicinal properties. You know, that's really grounded in cultural strengths And it also gives us an opportunity to learn about different types of plants and in the natural environment. So I think that's really fabulous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm also reminded of our conversation from earlier this week. We were talking about that article from Nonprofit AF, great resource, about, you know, ways that we can shift the paradigm as far as, you know, funding and organizations. And it occurred to me that there's, you know, this stigma associated with fiscal sponsorship and, you know, that we can really support the core programmatic efforts in a better way with organizations throughout the Portland metro area that might not necessarily have, you know, all of the insurance requirements necessary to carry out some work through that fiscal sponsorship. And I feel like that's a way that some of our mainstream environmental education organizations can support some of the smaller, more grassroots efforts within communities of color. We had Chris Bruno on the show last week, and I know she had a really great series of events through Quest Into Nature up at Powell Butte on Saturday and Tuesday afternoon, I believe. And, you know, she shared that some of these families that came out were, you know, planting camas and getting really jazzed about, you know, learning about the historical, you know, uses of these plants, the cultural connection, and also just, you know, learning about how to plant. And, you know, that just feels like such a powerful metaphor for what we're doing as a whole. Yes. Mm-hmm. So we're just about at time. We're going to transition into our next interview. But do you have any final words of wisdom that you would like to share?
That's tough. Yeah, I think, you know, just for folks to really think about the work that they're doing, why they're doing it, who they're working with, who they're not working with, to always be asking that question. Yeah, who are they seeing and how are they seeing the work of others, and seeing that as value added to what they're doing, and to feel like you don't necessarily have to change everything about what you're doing, but look up, you know, look up and look out for the partners who may be able to complement your efforts. And again, you know, how do you use your capital to connect and to share resources, and again, you know, continue to deepen that analysis and relationships across difference. And
fabulous.
It's exciting to see what, you know, might happen.
Yes. So, yeah, agreed. Agreed. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank
we've
you,
had
Carrie.
Tracy
so
Price
much.
Here with us. We've got Denise Wickert coming up next. And in the meantime, we will be playing a little cut for y'all. Rise and Shine from Indigenize.
If you ain't afraid to build a nation, stand over here, we the revolution, yeah.
Are we bursting from the ashes? Can you hear all things yearning for the push?
And we're back.
coming up this morning on KBOO. It's 9 at Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell bringing you the news you're not supposed to know.
At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Per Fegering details the inside story of the Saudi Knight of Long Knives, the preemptive coup by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia.
And at 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary.
At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein.
At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks to Ray Armantrout about her new book, Partly, a collection of her most brilliant pieces that affirms her reputation as a sharp and innovative writer.
KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
All right. So for our next interview today, we have Denise. Denise is a Umatilla tribal member who was born and raised near Pendleton, Oregon. Spending most of her life living on the reservation and working with tribal youth, she has a wealth of knowledge about community needs, culture, and prevention services. Today, Denise spends a lot of her time with the urban youth of Portland. The time she spends with youth is not merely about community and relationships, but about reinventing what it means to be Native today. Welcome to the show, Denise.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Yes, thank you for being here. So to start, would you mind talking about what it's been like to move from the reservation to the city of Portland? Just a little background.
So I was born and raised near Pendleton, Oregon, on the Umatilla Indian Reservation. It's a pretty small reservation. We have about 3,000 enrolled members for our tribe. I'm also Yakima and Nez Perce, but my citizenship is with the Umatilla tribes. And I, as an adult, I've only worked for the tribes.
Okay.
I've worked for entities such as our tribal casino, our tribal governance center, and our tribal clinic. So coming from that background and having my first job outside of the reservation, let alone in an urban population, it's been quite the transition. For one, traffic is crazy. Just getting here today was very nerve-wracking.
Right.
I've lived in the Portland area for about a little bit over a year and a half now. So getting used to traffic and, you know, trying to find different areas of, you know, whatever I'm doing for work or, you know, social events, it's rough because my house back home was like 17 miles out in the middle of nowhere. It was like literally like uphill both ways. So it's definitely a transition. And also coming from a space where I knew everybody growing up, the people that I worked with, I knew them as a youth. Mm-hmm. And being around people that talk like me and, you know, look like me or act like me, and being fully immersed in my culture, I didn't realize, or I took it for granted, the opportunities that I had there for culture, such as regular cultural activities and understanding language of our tribes, and coming here and not hearing, you know, people say good morning in the languages that we have, and it was normal. You know, hearing somebody say Tots Mewi, that's, you know, good morning in the Cayuse Nez Perce language, or Nich Maiski, that's good morning in Umatilla. If I were to say that to anybody here, you know, they're like, what the heck, you know? So it's different. And adjusting my mannerisms to the community and population that I'm serving now, it's been quite the transition. And also with the youth that I work with back home, working with the youth, I saw them all the time. I lived in the projects while I was working at the tribal clinic. So working like across the street from where I live, the kids knew where I lived. And then
no
the
boundaries.
Yeah, there's no boundaries. Yeah. You know, and I had a lot of kids call me Auntie too.
Yeah.
So I was Auntie to like 50 res kids running around, and they knew where I lived. So if they needed anything or I had a youth in crisis, my house was always available. And it was great. It was a good feeling. And I didn't understand that it was weird until I moved to Portland, you know, because when I was at my office and I needed to, you know, catch, like, say, a high school student, our tribal, our community school is just across the parking lot from my office. So I could literally just walk across the parking lot. go and find this youth, or I knew where they lived. It was nearby. I'd go to their house and be like, hey, man, what's up? You know, check in with them. And whereas here, it's so spread out, and trying to find the youth, I found it difficult because of how large the area is.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. I think, like what you said about just going from being culturally immersed to Portland, where it's, you know, or a larger cultural-less society, like that transition in itself just must have been like night and day, just completely different. But thanks for sharing that. Will you talk a little bit more about what it's been like building a new community for yourself as well? I feel like, I mean, talking about work and working with, connecting with the youth here, but would you mind talking about how it's been, you know, connecting with natives in Portland, or how does one do that?
So for me, that has been one of the biggest struggles. I've always struggled with the idea of like having a social life outside of work, because right. Before I was so immersed in my community and my social life was kind of like my work life. I mean, I would see the kids I worked with at community events, family gatherings, you know, so it was pretty common. Whereas here, I don't have family members here in the Portland area. So I didn't realize how much I relied on my family as well for social interactions. So being here, I have tried to attend like Native specific events, such as like local powwows or craft bazaars and vendor options that I see. I follow a lot of groups on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
I also was a participant in the LEAD program last year, which luckily I met both of you lovely ladies.
Shout out.
Yeah, shout out to the LEAD program with Naya. And that honestly did help me a lot with meeting, you know, Native professionals in the Portland area, and to build my network and to create this support group for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And being here for a little bit over a year and a half, I haven't had the opportunity to meet as many Natives as I'd like. Mm-hmm. But I have, you know, I have met other, you know, people from different backgrounds as well. And I do appreciate the diversity and culture here in Portland. It's just different for myself to, I guess, get involved in this super mixed culture where I'm so used to just the reservation and small town Pendleton area. You know, I don't, It's been quite the transition. So getting involved with like the NAIA LEAD program really helped me out with meeting people and following groups on Facebook, like the, you know, the Portland Natives Connect. And then there's like multiple other ones. And I just try to jump on with different events.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. Let's go back to talking about your work with tribal youth. And you've worked with tribal youth for quite a while. And we've talked about the need for positive identity in relation to culture. So tying identity and culture together. Can you talk with us a little bit about how teaching Native American or Alaska Native values like helps today's youth?
Yes. So like in the work that I do and the work I've been doing, using culture as a tool to help youth identify who they are and to kind of reintroduce the idea of the positivity that comes with being Native.
Mm-hmm.
Because youth may experience like the harshness of what the media has created for Natives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, oh, they're just redskins or they're savages. You know, when an individual is born as Native and they are raised and seeing these things from society and not valued as who they really are, it's tough. They don't want to associate themselves with this negative connotation that, you know, the majority society has created. And also understanding that some youth are, you know, they might be Native or they are Native, but they may not be raised traditional because for Native Americans, it wasn't cool to be Native with the U.S. government. The U.S. government has created such a long genocide for this population. And it was merely because that Native Americans were in the way of the land that they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So through generations of, you know, genocide of, you know, the killing Native Americans and then transitioning to trying to get natives to kill themselves off through quantum and enrollment requirements or boarding schools and relocation programs. There's a lot of things that the U.S. government did to try to create a slow genocide of this population. Mm-hmm. So there's a population that was kind of trained to not want to be native because it would create harm for themselves and their family. So, but now it's okay to be native. There's programs and support and knowledge that, yes, we could revitalize our culture. We could use it to be strong people. But we're going to try to do this in a way to heal those that have been affected by all these terrible things that have happened to our people. So there are still generations alive that were forced into boarding schools. Like my grandmother, I have aunts and uncles. So it's not that far back. Mm-hmm. So youth might be raised in an area where they see these adults coping in unhealthy ways with the idea of what it really means to be Native American. And unhealthy coping could look like alcohol and drug abuse, violence. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, Native Americans have the highest per capita rate of poverty. And for youth to see this, you know, they might witness somebody coping in a negative way and, you know, say like, oh, Native pride, blah, blah, blah. You're like, oh, man, I don't want to be that Native.
Right.
You know, they don't understand that. Mm-hmm. But getting youth involved in the culture to see this is Native pride, mm-hmm. you know, attending canoe journey, you know, really you have to be sober mm-hmm. to be on the canoe. You have to respect the canoe. You have to respect the water. You have to respect nature and doing that in the right way. So teaching youth in the ways that are real traditional values of not using alcohol and drugs as a coping and to acknowledge the space that we're in and the resources that we have. And utilizing our ancestors' strengths and, you know, such things as like canoe journey, dancing, singing, you know, utilizing nature's space for, you know, camping, hunting, gathering, fishing, and doing those in the right way, because it's important for them to understand that our ancestors prayed for them to be here mm-hmm. and to continue to live and to live in this way. So that is how, you know, I feel bringing culture to Native youth and having them understand that alcohol is not our culture. Mm-hmm. Commercial tobacco is not our culture. Drugs are not our culture. This is not what our people were meant to do.
Right. That's powerful. Another question I have, just, I mean, we're getting close to the end of our time of this interview, but just wanting to ask a question, you know, do you have any advice for people in the Portland metro area listening who might be interested, who may never have been in spaces of Native culture or never, you know, participated in an event or powwow or anything that they've, you know, been able to immerse themselves in this culture? Like, how can this be something that can be shared as well?
I think one of the great things is that with the new Senate bill of having Native history needed in Oregon schools, I think that's a huge step.
Right.
So there's a generation right now being taught the real history of Native Americans, and I think that's amazing. But then there's this gap of adults now that you're like, hey, you know, we didn't have the opportunity. So I think for anybody in the Portland metro area that would like to understand a little bit more about Native Americans or to meet Native Americans that, you know, practice their culture, powwows are a great experience. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, they're open to the public, they're free. And it's kind of a safe way to observe. And when you're observing, to make sure you're observing in a respectful way. If, you know, there's a blessing, you know, people generally stand for blessings. You know, and just kind of take social cues from those around you of what everybody else is doing. So I invite people to attend a powwow and support the Native vendors that are generally at those powwows, because that is their life. Mm-hmm. You know, support real Native vendors, not Native inspired, because it's really important right. that these people have been using tools that they've learned from generations before them, and they've created this art and they want to sell it. So I highly recommend that. And also, like seeing what natives look like today. Mm-hmm. You don't even know how many times I've heard, like, do you still live in a teepee? No. No, I live in an apartment here in the Portland area, like most of you. Like, and I think one of the youth I worked, I went to the Corbett Elementary School and helped with basket weaving. And one of the youth actually trick-or-treated at my place, and I felt like she was so surprised to see I lived in an apartment. And oh my gosh. I was like, yep, just like you, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't live in a teepee, but no, it was really cute. But I think it's important for people to understand that we have these traditional values and we have our culture and we want to respect our culture, but we're also walking in two worlds. Mm-hmm. So we do live in modern houses, apartments. We pay rent just like everybody else and we drive cars generally like everybody else. I didn't come in today on a horse. And, you know, so I think understanding that, yes, we are in two worlds. And so when you go to a powwow, you're very respectfully and observing. And if you're asked to participate, it's okay to say no. You know, don't feel like you're forced to do anything. I know, like, our powwow back home for 4th of July, we do a, like, wannabe contest where we invite non-tribal people to come out and dance. And it's like a little contest. And it's great because you see some people are like, oh, man, like, I'm really, like, I met a guy who travels, like, over 4 hours every year just to attend that part. Wow. And it's great.
That's dedication.
Yeah, it is. He's very dedicated. And, you know, and it's just like, you know, just to give people a taste of, like, you know, they'll have like a little mini coach for like 2 minutes mm-hmm. and then they go out and try to dance, you know, and it's great. But you don't have to participate in that way. It's just, you know, being there, being present, being respectful and supporting, you know, the local native vendors. And, you know, and if somebody is around you and you just want to meet them or introduce yourself to the vendors and, you know, I'd really like to learn more about your craft, that's great. Because from my experience, native people are willing to share.
Mm-hmm.
So...
just like that. It's like Denise sharing today. It's true.
Yes. I love sharing. And I think it's important to be able to share in a way of trying to break this image that mm-hmm. Mainstream media has created for natives, you know, of not being the stereotype of, you know, being a savage, you know, being this redskin or being this, you know, drunken Indian, you know, no, we're not like that. Mm-hmm. Generally, we are not like that. And I think it's important for them to also see that not all of us look like, you know, dark skin, black hair.
Mm-hmm.
I myself, I'm half German and half native. So I look different than, you know, Pocahontas, obviously. But, you know, and I think it's important for people to understand, like, the diversity within Native Americans as well, right. Even just within Oregon. I've worked with the 9 federally recognized tribes of Oregon for about 5 years now. And just seeing the diversity within the Oregon tribes it's amazing. It's beautiful. And within these tribal nations, there's smaller clans or other tribes. And they're just as diverse with their own language, their own customs, their own ways of, you know, accepting, you know, different times of the year and how they celebrate the different seasons or different events and the different foods that mm-hmm. they honor as their first foods. It's a beautiful thing. And, you know, we have longhouse tribes, we have plankhouse tribes, you know, and just seeing the difference of those nations, understanding it as well, it's beautiful. I love it.
Love that. And it kind of brings us back to, you know, our interview with Tracy Price, where we're talking about, you know, the environment too, and, you know, each of those communities too also has a different environment and a different need in that way as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Well, thank you for being here today, Denise.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, thank you for having me. Katsiaya, that means thank you in our language, and I'm just so honored to have this opportunity to represent, you know, not only myself, but my family and my tribe and the tribal community today, because it's a great honor to mm-hmm. be in that position and to be able to, I hope that they feel I've represented it in a good way. My intentions are, you know, to do this with a good heart and a clear mind. And thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you, Denise.
Thanks to all of our listeners for joining us for our second edition of Native Voices from the Edge.
That's right. So continuing the conversation from last week, we are still celebrating Native American Heritage Month, and there are still several events out there. If you'd like to roll through. Today, the Native Wellness Week at Portland State University in the PSU Native American Student and Community Center is presenting Healthy Minds, Healthy Bodies. Wellness Walk and Lunch take place from 9 a.m. till 4 p.m., followed by the Indigenous Artists Collective Network from 5 till 7. On Friday, there's a beading workshop all day long from 9 a.m. till 3:30 p.m., and I was chatting with a PSU student the other day who was saying that they really want this to be a community-wide event. It's on campus, so of course, Native students at PSU are particularly invited to participate, but it's open to the community as a whole. Also, tonight, an event is taking place at Havarah Shalom, Water is Life. Youth Speak Out Against Fracked Gas Exports. I think John mentioned it at the top of the hour, but some Klamath, Yurok, Koopa, and Karuk youth have traveled all the way from Southern Oregon and Northern California to share their perspective and a video recently produced by the Klamath tribes in opposition to the massive proposals to pipe, liquefy, and export fracked gas through the Northwest. Let's see, we've got plenty of other opportunities coming up. Next week, we will not be here physically. We will have a pre-recorded audio to share with everyone. So because we won't be there, I'll mention now that the Native Family Day and Marketplace is taking place, thanks to Portland Parks and Recreation, on Saturday, November 25th from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m. So this will be a day to celebrate community with our families and free crafts, swimming, roller skating, and snacks. Fry bread taco fundraiser at noon. And this is also an opportunity to get a jump on that special gift from one of our many talented Native artists who will be there as vendors. Another way to connect with the Native community is through the Oregon Native American Chamber. Their networking luncheon is happening on November 29th. This event provides a unique opportunity to meet, network, and build relationships with business and community members, Native and non-Native, from across Oregon and Southwest Washington. They have a guest speaker, Steve Havelka, who created pdxprocurementsearch.com and expanded statewide with oregonprocurementsearch.com. It's a search engine for government contracts and procurement opportunities. Think Google, but for bids and RFPs with local government agencies. And looking ahead, the 7th annual NEA Winter Marketplace is happening on Saturday, December 9th. So plenty of opportunities for your holiday shopping coming right on up.
Annette, thanks to all of our listeners for joining us for our second edition of
Native Voices from the Edge.
And we have to reunite. I said, better gather up our warriors, cause tonight is the big fight. Hey, 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 hey. Oh, 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 oh. Hey, 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 hey.
As I mentioned, we won't be here physically next week, but we'll be back on November 30th for our final blowout episode of Native Voices from the Edge. I'm Carrie Waters.
And I'm Amory Shack. Our engineer is John Shuck. Thanks, John. Now stay tuned for Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. ¶¶
Good morning, it's 8:58. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up, Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, it's Fight the Empire. Per Fogarang details the inside story of the Saudi Knight of Long Knives, the preemptive coup by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Flashpoints is on at 10:15. Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks to Ray Armantrout about her new book, Partly, a collection of her most brilliant pieces that affirms her reputation as a sharp and innovative writer. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. It's 8:59.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual Know Your City Gala, Untold Stories, on Thursday, November 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the EcoTrust Event Space in Portland. Untold Stories is Know Your City's second annual benefit gala, and it raises essential funds to further Know Your City's programs of engaging everyday Oregonians in the history, culture, and civics of the region. This year's gala will bring together over 150 guests for an unforgettable evening, including hors d'oeuvres, drinks, dessert, performances from local talent, and a paddle raise. Again, that's the second annual Know Your City Gala, Untold Stories, on Thursday, November 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the EcoTrust Event Space, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue, Suite 200 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.